I put a little insert in your bulletins today that has the outline of the main scripture that we're focusing on. If you don't have a bulletin, it might be helpful, particularly if you're a visual person, to have one of those. So maybe somebody at the back there could look out. If you need a bulletin or you need one of those inserts, just lift your hand and Floyd and Jay will grab you one. Otherwise, you might be able to share with people around you. We look good, Floyd. Thank you. So this is week two of a million part series on the book of Romans. We're going to be doing this from now until the time I retire. So that's how it goes. The book of Romans was written by the apostle Paul, and the main issue of what was going on in Rome was at the time, and why Paul specifically was the perfect one to be writing to them, was that you have Jewish believers and Gentile believers all trying to worship together. Again, Christianity did not exist yet. The religion that we're talking about is Judaism, and you had all of these non-Jews stepping in, and they had to figure out what did that look like? What did that mean? The reason Paul was the perfect person to be writing this letter was because Paul was specifically called as an apostle to the Gentile believers, a way of trying to negotiate and understand what does Judaism look like now that Jesus Christ has come, now that the promised Messiah has come. What does it look like now that we have this Son of God who's died on the cross for us, who's risen again to new life for us, when in the past all we had was the law and this covenant? So this letter and most of Paul's letters, he is wrestling through some of these issues. The main idea or the thesis of this letter is what we looked at last week, is from Romans 1:16-17. And this is the verse as a whole reads, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel." This is again Paul writing. "I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed through faith for faith. As it is written, the one who is righteous will live by faith." Now, to just kind of summarize that, because Paul is very wordy. And sometimes I think in the original language, he maybe wasn't quite as wordy, but it's hard to translate Greek to English. And sometimes you need more words in English than you would have had in Greek. And sometimes the grammar is funny. So the summary of what the main point or the thesis of this letter is this. He's talking about the gospel, and he has two things to say about the gospel. The gospel itself, the proclamation of what God did in Jesus, that is the power of God for salvation, and it is in it the righteousness of God is revealed. In it, God's faithfulness to always be who he is revealed. And that's the main point. And we're going to come back to that every single week because that's the main point of the letter. If you get nothing else, this is what the gospel is. If people are walking down the street and they say, "Hey, I hear you go to church. Tell me, what is the gospel?" This is what it is. It's the power of God for salvation. And in the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed. Now, if that could stand alone, then there wouldn't be a whole letter to the Romans. But it takes Paul 16 chapters to kind of unpack what that means. And so this week is the beginning of unpacking what he means by the words, the gospel. Now, sometimes we think of the words gospel and we think about those books in the Bible, right? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Well, they are simply called gospels because they are the written proclamation of what God did in Jesus Christ. So Paul's not referring to the book of Matthew. He's referring to the actual act of what it was that God was about in Jesus Christ. And this is kind of, it's going to be a little bit difficult because for five chapters, it takes him five chapters to unpack exactly what it was that God did through Jesus Christ. And he always starts with the bad news first. He always starts, and this, what we're looking at today, is very much, he's setting up and he's saying, this is how bleak things were for humanity. And because I can't preach through five whole chapters in one sitting, it's all we're going to stick with is, this is how bleak things were, how dark things were, how awful things were. Now, I'm going to look ahead and say, but there's hope at the end, so hopefully you won't leave church and just want to crawl into a hole and never come out, because it is good news. And the point is that he sets up the bad news first so that the good news actually looks like good news. And he starts with difficult words. This is how this passage today, we're starting at Romans 1:18-32. It begins this way. "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of those who by their wickedness suppress the truth. Wow, the wrath of God. Now, I don't think I've ever preached a sermon on the wrath of God. You may never have heard a sermon on the wrath of God. Except I feel like if I'm going to preach a sermon on the wrath, we should have a smaller pulpit so I can shake it and maybe throw it off and, you know, yell and scream and wave my arms about how God's judgment is coming. And all of you sinners, God has been so angry at you. You know, when I was doing my course, our prof asked a simple question, what is meant by the wrath of God? And pretty much all of us went, well, it's God's anger. And I don't know about you, but we realized that we all had this picture in our minds of God being like this parent who's just sick and tired of his toddler's bad behavior. And maybe he spanks the toddler or makes him go sit in the naughty chair over in the corner or says, oh, go over to that room. I can't talk to you right now. Do any of you have that kind of image when we hear the wrath of God? This is God is just, he's just fed up. He's fed up because humanity is wandering away. He's fed up because humanity is mean to each other, or they're dealing with oppression, or they're whatever it is they're doing. God is just fed up, and so he's just going to smite some people. He's going to rain down thunder and lightning from heaven, and Logan, watch out, because it's going to get you, right? Like, this is the wrath of God. He knows. He's Big Brother up in the sky watching, and he knows what you've been up to, and if you're not careful, the wrath of God is out to get you. How many good, solid Christians have prayed for the wrath of God to get to the person? Not beside them, because you're never sure about God's aim with lightning, but maybe the person two pews in front of them, right? Like, how many of us, honestly, there's times when we like the idea of the wrath of God for other people, because we want God to get angry. We want him to punish those who need to be punished. The problem is that none of that's actually terribly, hugely accurate. And this passage is going to help us understand what the wrath of God is. Yes, there is righteous anger of God. But God is not this parental figure who's just given up and gotten fed up with his children. And he's saying, you naughty children, I've had enough of you. That's not who God is. This whole service, we've been singing and we've been hearing verses of scripture that remind us of the greatness and the majesty and the awesomeness of God. Rick and Carolyn and Martin and Joanne told us about places that they had seen as they traveled out east that just opened their eyes up to the majesty of God's creation. This God who has created extraordinary beauty, this God who is unbelievably good, is the same God we're talking about when we talk about the wrath of God. Paul writes, and this is the beginning of him trying to explain what the gospel is, what the good news, what the proclamation about Jesus is. He starts by saying, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness. Now, the word wickedness is probably better defined. Wicked is just a very broad general term. The word that's being used, that Paul used, had a more narrow meaning of injustice. So God is crying out, the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness, everything that is contrary to God's nature, against all injustice. Our God is a great God of justice, of those who by their wickedness or by their injustice suppress the truth. And the reason I wanted to give you this in your bulletins is because the wrath of God, he's going to come back to later on. And I can't ever show that on PowerPoint. You can't put that many words on a PowerPoint screen. And so the first thing he focuses on is suppress the truth. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against who? Against those who by their wickedness, by their injustice, by their ungodliness, suppress the truth. Suppress what truth? We live in the postmodern age. What is truth? Who? My truth could be different than your truth, which could be different than your truth. Who's suppressing what truth? The unwritten words here are who suppress the truth about God, who suppress the truth about who God is, the nature of God who is the creator. And then Paul unpacks it and he says, what is the truth? What is the truth about God? And this is what he writes. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things he has made. We just pause here for a second. This is extraordinary here. Paul is saying everyone can know God just by looking around. And it points back. It recalls the idea of the creation story. Adam and Eve walking around in this incredible, majestic beauty of the Garden of Eden. And they could just look around and know God. Everything about God is plain because God has shown it to him. God has revealed himself through absolutely everything that he has made. When you stand back and you stare at mountains or at a lake, or you're out fishing and you're just in the sunrise or the sunset, whatever time you go fishing at, or you're watching a field or any of the beauty of just a simple flower that you see, all of that reveals God's awesomeness and his beauty. There's a reason why so many of the hymns that we sing that are about God's greatness and God's glory have verses written about creation. To God be the glory, great things he has done. You know, it speaks of Jesus Christ, but it also, in the other verses, it also speaks of the great creation. And Paul is saying, ever since the creation of the world, God's eternal power, his divine nature, even though they're invisible, they have been understood and seen through the things he has made. So they are without excuse. Who's the they they're talking about? Those who suppress the truth. There's nobody who suppresses the truth because they don't know it. What Paul is saying is, come on, people, just look around. Open your eyes. Look at this incredible, spectacular universe that God has created. There's no excuse. For though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. Who we honor, who we give thanks to, that's who we worship. I want to pause there for just a second. We come to this place and we give thanks to God. And we say we come to this place and we worship God. But I wonder who we worship during the week when we're not here. And the main thing is to say, who are we giving thanks to? At what points are we giving thanks to this great nation that we live in for the privileges that we have? At what point are we giving thanks to our education? At what point and in what ways are we giving thanks to our bank accounts that we can do the things that we can do? Who we give thanks to points to who we worship. Who we worship points to who we have set up as the gods in our lives. And this is where Paul goes. He says, for they knew God and they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their senseless minds were darkened. And then he goes here. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. They exchanged the glory. This is the main point here about suppressing the truth. They exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling a mortal human being or birds or four-footed animals or reptiles. Here people are surrounded by the majesty of creation. And instead of worshiping and giving thanks to the one who created it, they pick up those things that have been created and worship and give thanks to them and make idols. We think of ancient times of the idols that have been made, and you can buy all sorts of statues from various corners of the world of idols that have been worshipped. The point is that people, even though they knew there had to be a creator, they looked around at the stars in the sky and they knew that there had to be a creator. Rather than worshiping the creator, they worship the things that the creator had made. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and injustice of those who by their wickedness suppress the truth. What's the truth? Is that God is awesome and God has created this extraordinary world and God alone is the creator. What does it mean that we suppressed the truth? Means that we chose to ignore God who is the creator and instead lift up things that have been created and worship those things. And then this is where the tie-in goes to the wrath of God. So what's the result of that? What is the result of the suppression of the truth? The result is the wrath of God. But Paul doesn't use that term again. Instead, Paul uses this term. Therefore, God gave them up. And if you were to read through this further, and I'm not going to quote all of this, just this is enough, because he repeats this three times. Therefore, God gave them up. Therefore, God gave them up. Therefore, God gave them up. And this is the clue, this therefore God gave them up. This is the clue to what the wrath of God is all about. It's not about God saying, Sue, your behavior this week was miserable and I'm going to smite you. You're going to come down with a cold because you were so miserable. No, sometimes we just get colds. God gave them up. And the reason it's in three times, he repeats it three times in Romans, is because he gives them up to different things. He gives them up. What are the natural consequences of the gods that you choose to worship and give thanks to? What are the natural consequences of the choices that you make and how you live your life? What are the natural consequences if you choose to work 80 hours a week? The natural consequence is soon your kids don't know who you are. The natural consequence is burnout, depression, anxiety, and any number of other physical ailments that are knocking out North America by the thousands. What are the consequences if you make choices to live a life that says it's all about my sexuality and it's all about sex? What are the consequences of that? I don't think I could even count the number of diseases that are out there simply because we as a society have said anything goes. I have so many conversations with young women especially who still believe, and I know you women who are on the leading edge of getting women to understand that they were worth something in life, I'm sorry to tell you this, but there are still way too many young women who believe that they only have any worth in our society if there's a guy out there who wants to sleep with them. God gave them up. It's about consequences. It's not about God raining down lightning and thunder to smite us and just avenge himself and work out his anger on us. It's God saying, okay, you want to worship other gods? You want to set other things, things that I created? You want to lift those up and follow those and serve those and become slaves to those? There's going to be consequences to that. There's a natural order to it. If you're a parent, you know what happens if there's no consequences to your children's behavior, right? You know what happens if your kid is throwing temper tantrums in the grocery store and you just do whatever they want to shut them up. They keep throwing temper tantrums in the grocery store. Whereas if the consequence is that you walk away and they get left all by themselves, they have to deal with those consequences. It's hard to sit back and watch people we love live out the consequences of their behavior. But that's love, isn't it? Because if they don't do that, they don't learn. And God says, you have the freedom to worship whatever you want. You have the freedom to serve whoever and whatever you want. You can make all these choices. I have done everything in my power by creating this most incredible world so that you would know me and fall in love with me and want to serve only me who has created you, who's filled you up, who's called you human, who when you follow me, you discover the riches of being human, of what it is to be filled with humanity. But if you want to choose to follow these other gods, if you want to choose to serve something that I created, something that isn't worth serving, then there's going to be consequences to that. See, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and all injustice of those who by their wickedness suppress the truth. We lie to ourselves all the time. We could look around and it's clear as day, but we lie and we rationalize. And the reality is, the only God worth worshiping, the only God who does not dehumanize us, is the Creator God. Paul is setting up here, he's saying, okay, this is where it starts. He says, yeah, I've got this great message to tell you about the gospel, which is the power of God for salvation, which through which the righteousness of God is revealed. The gospel is this incredible thing. But if you're going to get how incredible it is, you have to get how horrible things begin, what the state of humanity and relationship with God is, where it starts. And where it starts is here. Chose every god except for God. And God left them to the consequences of that. God gave them up. The nature of the idols that we worship is the nature of the consequences that we live with. Two examples of modern day idols that I think that we like to worship: Mammon, the god of Mammon, who we grant absolute sovereignty to economic forces, whatever the cost. We think the markets rule everything. We have bought into this idea that you have to have more and more and more money. You have to save it. You have to hoard it. You have to hold on to it. You have to be able to spend it on things that are good for you, that the more you can have, the more power you have, the better your life is going to be. And what's the result of worshiping the god of Mammon? What are the consequences of that? The consequences are that around the world, there are people who are starving, who shouldn't be starving. There's entire nations where the natural resources are being ripped apart, are being destroyed completely because big businesses are saying, we need that ground for this kind of stuff. We're growing corn and we're not using it to feed hungry people. We're using it to put gas in cars. How brutal is that, that there are people who are starving and we're putting the corn in the gas tanks of our cars? This is a society that worships Mammon. It's about famine. It's about oppression. Anything goes if you can make another buck. Why do so many large companies go to the developing world to have their factories there? Because nobody's watching. What can you get away with when nobody's watching? This is the consequence of worshiping the god of Mammon. The wrath of God. God gave them up. If you're going to worship this god instead of me, and God has spelled it out pretty clearly. There's over 2,000 verses in the Bible, for instance, just about poverty. If this is the god you're going to worship, these are the consequences. Another of the gods that we worship is the old Roman god Mars, the god of war. We have to fight for what's our right. And not just at a global scale, right? But in our own lives. We go into our interactions with each other as if we have rights that we need to fight for. And even if it means stomping all over the other person, we deserve it and therefore we have to fight for it. We worship this god of war, this Mars. And the result, globally, the result again is famine. The result is violence, death, destruction, hatred, bigotry. All of these kind of things are just the natural consequence of worshiping a god who is anything but the great creator God. When we lift up these kind of things, there are so many gods that we can choose to worship. And you can worship whoever you want. But Paul spells it out pretty clearly. He says, yeah, you can worship whoever you want. But when you suppress the truth, which is there is only one God who is creator, there is only one God who instills humanity in human beings. That's it. But when you suppress that truth, when you ignore it, and I don't mean suppress it to other people, suppress it to ourselves. Think about what you give thanks to during the week. Because that'll start to point your finger towards maybe what you're worshiping. Think about what are the consequences that you're living with. What are the things that are just destroying you week in and week out? My suggestion is that probably gives a bit of a hint of what maybe you're worshiping that is not the Creator God. And where's the hope in all of this? Well, the reality is the hope comes in about chapter 5, but I wanted to give you a heads up because I don't think we should wait till chapter 5 and just go home and say, you know what, we all just really suck. And this is the thing. God gave them up, but he didn't just walk away. This is the extraordinary thing. This is the gospel. Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. Why? Because it's the power of salvation. In it, the righteousness of God is revealed. God didn't say, okay, enough of you. Just live with what you've got, and I'm walking away from all of you. I've had it. You're all on your own. Now, there's all sorts of great stories in the Old Testament where it's put forward as if God does that. He says, okay, Israel, I'm done with you. Go away. You go over there. I'm going over here and don't talk to me. But he never, ever, ever just walks away. He never just leaves us to our own devices. This is the righteousness of God, that even though we stumble, even though we choose other gods, even though in the Bible the typical tendency of how it's worded is that even though the people of God cheat on him, commit adultery against God, he is still always faithful to his vows. He is always faithful to being our God. And so this is the gospel. The proclamation of what God did is that he sent Jesus Christ. And Jesus went to the cross and he died. That was the consequences of the gods that we as human beings have chosen to worship, is that we crucified the Messiah. We crucified the Son of God himself. And then God rose him from the dead. Death itself was conquered. And so he said, no, you still have consequences. There are still consequences to every choice that you make. But here's the good news. You aren't just left to those consequences. Through Jesus Christ, there is salvation. There is being saved from those consequences. Alcoholics know really well what it is to have to live with the consequences of their actions. In AA, one of the steps is that you have to make amends, because you recognize that even once you have become sober, there's still broken relationships spread all around you. And some of those can be healed and some of those can't be healed. And you do your best to heal those broken relationships. Even when you've become sober, even as you see God give you the strength every single day to try and not let alcohol rule your life, be the God of your life, you still have consequences that follow you around. But the good news is, you're not just left to wallow and to die in the pit of those consequences. As Jesus Christ was scooped up out of the grave into life, we are scooped up out of the pits of God's wrath, of the consequences of our choices and of our idols and of our gods. And we are reminded again how great and amazing and awesome the Creator is. And we are reminded again that if we turn to him and if we worship and give thanks to God only who created us, that's where we are most purely and most completely human as we were intended to be. This is a beautiful, amazing thing. And I'm really glad that Paul started with the dark and the ugly part, because I think we can take for granted the beautiful and amazing things that God did. We can just go, oh yeah, well, I'm saved and that's lovely, and go on with life. We forget how dark and miserable it is without Jesus Christ. And so the reason Paul starts here is because that's where we have to start. The good is only good when we can see it in comparison to what's so awful. Our eyes can be accustomed to dark so that we forget that there's something lighter, something brighter out there. And Paul wants to remind the Romans, and I think wants to remind us, of the greatness of the God who created us, the only God worthy of our worship.